This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of today's show, we will look back to the early days of the American occupation of Iraq. And our guest for the program is Rajiv Chandrasekaran. He is assistant managing editor at the Washington Post. And he also, back in 19—let me start all over again. He is assistant managing editor of the Washington Post, and he's worked there since 1994. Before, he served as the bureau chief in Baghdad for the Post. He also worked in Cairo and in Southeast Asia. He also was correspondent covering the war in Afghanistan. He is the author of a newly published book that is titled Imperial Life in the Emerald City, Inside Iraq's Green Zone, and is published by Knopf. He is now out spending some time traveling around talking about the book. He's in California this morning, and he's joining us by telephone. And as we talk, questions are welcome. The only thing that we ask of people who call in is that they're brief in their comments, and we ask that so we can keep the program moving, get in as many callers as possible. But the idea is that if you have a question, you are certainly welcome to call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the number to call. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and that's 800-222-9455. 333-WILO and toll-free 800-222-WILO. Whichever number works for you, you give us a call, and we'd be very happy to have you in the conversation. Rajiv Chandrasekaran, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, we appreciate it. There are several sort of basic points that you make about the Coalition Provisional Authority and how things ran. And maybe we can sort of hit some of the high points, and then we can go in and perhaps do some filling in of detail. And perhaps one of the most basic points, if you point to things that were wrong here, that went wrong almost from the very start, it seemed that one of the fundamental problems with the CPA was isolation. And that is that the people who were living in this very small area of Baghdad, the Green Zone, had very little, maybe almost no idea what life was like for the people of Iraq, and how it was that they were trying to cope and what it is that they really needed. And that when the United States went about trying to create this little bubble for people to live in and provide them with the comforts of home to the extent that they could, it really worked against their having any sort of a contact with the people that they were trying to help.
You're exactly right. And what happened was that the American civilians who showed up in Baghdad right after the fall of Saddam Hussein's government back in April and May 2003 set themselves up and built this bubble that was thoroughly disconnected from the realities on the ground in post-war Iraq. They set themselves up in what is now called the Green Zone, a 7-square-mile enclave in the center of Baghdad. It's home to the Republican Palace, the former seat of government under Saddam's government, but taken over subsequently by Ambassador Bremer, America's viceroy to Iraq in the first 15 months of the occupation. And what they did was they built themselves a little America. It was a place where they, for instance, served pork bacon for breakfast. This is in the middle of a Muslim country, and many Muslims find pork to be a very offensive food product. They set up bars and a disco, and Halliburton brought in scores of brand new Chevy Suburbans, and they built Chinese restaurants and gymnasiums, and they had things like salsa dancing classes and Bible study classes, and it was a sort of a city unto itself and very comfortable for many of the Americans. Halliburton refilled the swimming pool behind the palace, and you could have a fairly decent life. Yes, there were some threats of mortars coming in, and it wasn't Club Med, but what it was a world that was really removed from the world outside the walls, the world that the Iraqi people were living in. So, for instance, inside the Green Zone, you had 24-hour-a-day electricity. You had air conditioning on in your offices. Outside, people were getting maybe 8-10 hours of power a day. Infrastructure wasn't working. There was no clean water coming out of the taps. And what this meant was that the people on the inside really began to lose touch with the very people they were supposed to be working with to govern and reconstruct a nation.
I suppose that some people might say that it was necessary for things to run in the green zone like they did. Well, first of all, obviously the CPA couldn't do its job if they didn't have power, but also that security would have been an issue and that it was necessary for these people to be protected. And so, you know, the idea of people in the CPA kind of going on strolling down the street and having, you know, having little conversations with average Iraqis to talk about what they needed was kind of unrealistic.
Well, not in those early months, David. You know, in the first maybe 5, 6, 7 months after the liberation of Iraq, it was possible for Americans to drive out and about in the city, to talk to people on the street. Americans were viewed, particularly in the early months, as liberators, and they were welcomed. And there were brave Americans who worked for the Coalition Provisional Authority who did just that. I often had lunch with one former U.S. ambassador who was there, who just jumped in his car, put on his hat, and tucked a pistol under his jacket and drove out to a restaurant to meet me there. Look, there always would have to be a headquarters. I'm not suggesting that there didn't need to be a headquarters zone with security, but there was a way, I believe, to have done this that would have at least been a bit more culturally sensitive in terms of the food that was served, in terms of the access that Iraqis would have, and fundamentally in terms of setting up a structure that encouraged a degree of interaction and healthy communication between the occupiers and the occupied.
Another of the points that you make, and another of the serious problems here, seem to be that when selecting people to lead the rebuilding effort, perceived loyalty to the White House trumped expertise. So you had people who were being put in charge of rebuilding major parts of Iraqi infrastructure who had never done anything like that before.
Most certainly. Instead of sending the best and the brightest, in many cases we sent the loyal and the willing. And the result was that the Coalition Provisional Authority, that American occupation government in that crucial first 15 months, was hobbled by administration ideologues. Now, there's nothing wrong with an administration sending some political appointees. I mean, that's the prerogative of a White House. But instead of sending lots of people with skills in the Arabic language, experts in the Middle East, or people with skills in post-conflict reconstruction, what happened in many cases was that people were screened more for political loyalty. In fact, people were asked in their pre-deployment interviews questions such as, what are your views on Roe versus Wade? Did you vote for George W. Bush in the 2000 presidential election? I mean, what does this have to do with fixing Iraq? And you know, it was the whole venture was viewed by some at senior most levels of our government as in some way a kind of a political sinecure. They were going to send their friends and their loyalists out there, and it was, I think, initially regarded as, you know, not going to be that difficult of a job, so why don't we just give the positions to our pals, as opposed to trying to find the most talented people within the federal government and within the private sector in the United States and send them out there to Baghdad to help fix the country.
Yeah, and as a result, what happened was, I mean, not only did you have people that really didn't have the kind of expertise in terms of what they had done really to do this job, it wasn't just a matter of the fact that they lacked experience, but that their impulse, what it was they thought should be done, if they were looking at a particular problem, the solution that they came up with seemed also to be, let's say, shaped by or colored by political ideology as well.
Exactly. I mean, many of them viewed Iraq as this neoconservative terrarium. I mean, let's take economic development. It's a great example. You've got a country with 40% unemployment, maybe 50%. What do Ambassador Bremer's economic advisors suggest needs to be done? One of the first initiatives they undertook was a wholesale rewrite of Iraq's tax code. And they gave the Iraqis a dream of the neocons in this country, a 15% flat tax. I mean, here's a country that was crying out for sort of a New Deal-type jobs program. Get people to work, cleaning rubble from the streets, rebuild government ministries, clean out irrigation ditches in the south. But instead, we embarked on this sort of fanciful notion of trying to reform Iraq's economy so it could quickly join the World Trade Organization. They rewrote laws governing intellectual property, microchip designs, genetically modified seed varietals, new tariff laws, new laws allowing foreign investment in, and of course this tax law. And it, to many people, it seemed an exercise in sort of rearranging deck chairs in the Titanic, as opposed to really dealing with the fundamental issues in the economy and trying to just stimulate basic employment.
Yeah, another of the things that just sort of floored me was the people who were in charge of the trying to overhaul or bolster or repair the healthcare system. Here we had a place where the basic healthcare infrastructure, hospitals and so forth, had just been devastated. They didn't have even the most basic sort of things to try to take care of health problems. But the folks who were overseeing that apparently decided that the biggest problem that the Iraqis had was smoking. And so what they did was they instituted a campaign to try to get people to quit smoking.
That was certainly a top priority, and it sounds so laughable today. And it wasn't just that. It was an effort to rewrite the list of drugs Iraq's health ministry imports. Again, a lot of things that just were not focused in on reality. And you know, let me go back to the root cause of that in the healthcare system. And this is particularly galling, David. In the weeks before the war, the U.S. Agency for International Development dispatched one of its own people to Baghdad, or to Kuwait, and then to go to Baghdad to help rebuild Iraq's healthcare system. His name was Skip Burkle. He was a physician. He had a master's degree in public health. He taught post-conflict public health reconstruction at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, one of the foremost such institutions in the country. He had four postgraduate degrees, two Bronze Stars from the Navy. He had worked in Kosovo and in Somalia and northern Iraq after the 1991 Gulf War. One of his USAID colleagues called him the single most talented post-conflict public health care specialist working for the U.S. government. A few weeks after Baghdad's liberation, he was yanked back to the United States. A top official at USAID told him that the White House had decided it wanted a quote-unquote loyalist in the job. As I write in my book, Skip Burkle had a wall full of degrees, but he didn't have a picture with the president. The guy who was sent over there had no medical degree, had no experience in post-conflict healthcare reconstruction, was not a Middle East expert. He was the former director of community health in the state of Michigan, but he was buddies with Governor John Engler, the former Republican governor of Michigan, who recommended him to Paul Wolfowitz. That's how he got out to Baghdad. And this guy's top priority when he got there, at least one of his priorities, was mounting an anti-smoking campaign. Another was rewriting the list of drugs because he had done it in Michigan and he had saved millions of dollars for the state of Michigan. So he thought, it worked. It worked in Ann Arbor, so it might work in Baghdad. And it was quite simply, according to many people I've talked to, a total distraction, a waste of time. By the time he left the country and sovereignty was returned to the Iraqi people and the first Iraqi minister of health took over, a very talented World Health Organization individual, he did a study, a survey of prescription and drug stockpiles in Ministry of Health warehouses and in hospital dispensary shelves. And what he discovered was fully 40% of the drugs that his ministry deemed to be essential were out of stock. The Americans were spent more time rewriting the list and not enough time actually trying to acquire and distribute the necessary medicine the Iraqi people needed.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Rajiv Chandrasekaran. He is assistant managing editor of The Washington Post. From April 2003 until October 2004, he was the Post bureau chief in Baghdad, where he was responsible for covering the American occupation of Iraq. Before that, he was the Post Cairo bureau chief. Before that, he was the Post Southeast Asia correspondent based in Jakarta, Indonesia. He also covered the war in Afghanistan and is the author of the new book, Imperial Life in the Emerald City Inside Iraq's Green Zone. It's published by Knopf and looks at the early days of the American occupation of Iraq. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have a couple of here. We'll start with someone listening in Aurora this morning. It's line number one. Hello.
Hello, good morning. Mm-hmm. I had the pleasure of listening to the author on the Frontline program. I guess my questions are these. I don't think some of your thesis, it's not new. I mean, name one imperial power or name one occupying power that was sensitive to the people that were being occupied. Were the Romans concerned about what the Germans were eating when they occupied Germania? I mean, Persians, you name it. Name one occupying power that was sensitive. Having said that, it's really fascinating for me that this is coming from Washington Post. Where was this kind of investigative tone when the war was actually going on? Now when the war is going obviously bad, we have all these reporters coming out of from Washington Post, New York Times, and all the other media outlets saying how badly this was going. Let's do an investigative book. I'm just asking Mr. Chandrasekharan, is it, we all know it's going bad. We all know the follies of this war. So I guess, what is so new about your book?
Two good questions there. Let me take the first one first. You know, in previous cases of occupation, of invasion, you know, the occupying power wasn't trying to build a model democracy in a country, wasn't trying to go there with a stated war of liberation. I mean, when the Romans were out conquering people, they weren't out there working in the best interests or saying or claiming they were working in the best interests of the people who they were conquering and occupying. What we were doing in Iraq was billed as something very, very different without real historical precedent. And if you were, you know, out trying to liberate a people and trying to build a new stable government, well, I think it's incumbent to be mindful of the needs, the desires, the expectations of the people in the country that you're occupying. And I think it's incumbent on an occupying power to be culturally sensitive. As to the caller's second question, it is a question that many people have asked, and the short answer to this is I wasn't sitting on any of this information while I was there as a reporter in Iraq. We have to remember that the way the Coalition Provisional Authority was run like a little mini White House. Reporters just couldn't troll the halls talking to people. There was a press office there, and they insisted that reporters be escorted by minders, that interviews be supervised by a press officer. CPA officials were told that they were not to speak to reporters without a press person present. So our ability to really understand how things worked, to understand the degree to which political loyalty was involved in the selection process, the degree to which neoconservative philosophy guided policymaking. Some of that was known, but it really wasn't very well known. Myself and others really tried to dig, and you know, we got, you know, I think about as much as we could at the time. It wasn't until the Coalition Provisional Authority was dissolved, its staff returned back to this country, people went back to their old jobs, and these true believers, these card-carrying Republicans, began to realize that success was not around the corner, as they had assumed, that it wasn't just a few months away. You know, the first round of Democratic elections wasn't going to pacify the country. And over time, they became increasingly disillusioned, and they became willing to talk to people like myself. Most often not for attribution, but they started to share information, share email, share documents. So the bulk of the material in this book was really pulled together over the past year of reporting. It wasn't something that I was sitting on for 2 or 3 years. And you know, I would just commend the caller to actually read the book and look at what I have in there. And I think there's an awful lot of new and very revelatory material. It's an effort to really shine a light on what I think is the other fiasco here. We all know about the disastrous consequences to send too few troops to stabilize Iraq after the fall of Baghdad. We all know the consequences of Rumsfeld's and the Pentagon's failure to anticipate the growth of the insurgency. Well, there was a whole nother series of failures, of mistakes made by the civilians who went to govern and reconstruct Iraq, by Bremer and his staff. And I argue here, and I try to present a lot of compelling evidence, that their mistakes in many ways are just as responsible for the mess that we find ourselves in there today.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Let's go to Urbana for someone else here. Line number two. Hello.
You used a dirty word. You said culturally sensitive. And what I hear ultra-conservatives saying is sensitive. You're going to be sensitive to terrorists? Maybe culturally aware would get around that. I don't know. But it certainly seems that if we don't pay attention to sensibilities. If we inadvertently or on purpose insult people, we don't make friends of them, we turn them into enemies. And it seems to me when you have religious conservatives being selected for, which is implied in some of the questions you said people were asked, my experience with some is that, you know, you can be put down for being a Presbyterian. You know, you're not saved. You're not as good as I am. You're not going to go to heaven. And so we've got two groups. One of them saying, I'm going to go to heaven, and the other one saying, I'm going to go to heaven, and you're wrong. It's very frustrating to me to have people using... It's like, my God can beat up your God sort of attitude. You know, I'm better than you are because I'm going to be saved. I don't have to pay attention to the possibility that you might possibly have some good ideas in your religion, or that you might have... You might be a person who is trying to be true to your faith and trying to come up with a set of moral values that are consistent, and it may differ somewhat. You get what I'm trying to say. I just find it really, really bad when we have our leaders and our people like televangelists and even staff going over to there and putting people down for not being... Christian and are Christian enough. So do you have experience with that as well?
Well, I'd like to read just a little passage from the fifth chapter of my book to the caller here. And it deals with the selection process of people. And I write about a man named Munzer Fatfat, an American citizen of Lebanese descent, who had applied to be the senior advisor to the Iraqi Ministry of Youth and Sport. And he told me that he was asked during his interview at the White House liaison's office at the Pentagon whether he was a Republican or a Democrat and who he voted for. But then Mr. Fatfat, who is a Muslim, was asked about his religion. And he said, I told him I am a Muslim, but I'm married to a Christian. My children go to Catholic schools. I went to a Catholic school. He had to go through five separate interviews before he was sent out to Baghdad. And then I write, when he arrived in Baghdad, his faith once again became an issue. I quote now of what he says. He said to me, quote, one of Bremer's top aides asked me what my religion was. When I answered, he was surprised. Oh, you're a Muslim, he said. But you're not like a terrorist, are you? Then I write, as the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Fitr approached, a fellow senior advisor asked him exactly when it would begin. Fatfat explained that there was no firm date. It depended on when the first sliver of the moon was seen over Mecca. And then Fatfat says, quote, he said to me, this is stupid. This is in a week and you don't know when you're going to celebrate it. Fatfat said he was speechless.
I don't know what you can add to that. I think what I'm just going to do is go on and say thanks to the caller. We have some others. So let's go to someone on a cell phone in North Urbana. This is line number three. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment in response to not the previous caller, but the person before that. I agree with your guess that it might actually behoove that caller to actually read the book to see what's new about it. I also suggest that that caller actually go back and read books about World War II. We were an occupying force at the end of World War II in Europe and specifically in Japan, and we showed incredible sensitivity, and we actually made those countries into the democracies they are today. However wrongheaded we've gone about Iraq, we were and are still trying, and I'm sure we're going to be completely unsuccessful, in turning them into self-sufficient democratic societies. And the caller was simply wrong. It's not true that people don't have sensitivities to the lands that they take over. The United States has almost always tried to do that, and they certainly did at the end of World War II. So I'll just make that comment. Thank you.
All right. Rajiv, do you want to add anything to that?
Well, I tend to agree with this call. I think he makes a good point. When you look back at how U.S. forces and the U.S. government approached the post-war occupations of Germany and Japan. And, the stated goal with Iraq was to involve the Iraqi people to make this a consultative process. But it didn't happen. And what I detail in my book is how the American civilians got to Baghdad and cloistered themselves in this green zone and began to think that they had all the answers. And this is where we get the connection between the isolation of the green zone and the failures in policy. You had people sitting there in these nice air-conditioned rooms in the palace, diagramming on whiteboards how we're going to fix the Iraqi school system. Well, great, let's bring some elements of No Child Left Behind here. We have the answers, as opposed to going out and about and really engaging with the Iraqi people and hearing what they wanted and putting them in charge. I mean, fundamentally, the Iraqi people, and Iraq was not a thoroughly defeated aggressor nation like Germany or Japan after World War II. The Iraqi people did not believe they were the problem. They believed Saddam was the problem. Yes, they wanted American help in reconstructing their country, and even helping to birth an interim administration to govern the country. But what they didn't want was a full-on occupation. And that's where I think it all started to go downhill. They wanted to be liberated. Let there be no mistake about that. But they did not then want to be under the yoke of a foreign power occupying them for months on end.
Let me very quickly reintroduce the guest. Then we have another caller. Rajiv Chandrasekharan is assistant managing editor of the Washington Post. From April 2003 until October 2004, he was the Post bureau chief in Baghdad, where he was responsible for covering the American occupation of Iraq. He is the author of the new book, Imperial Life in the Emerald City, Inside Iraq's Green Zones, published by Knopf. He's spending some time now traveling, talking about the book. He's out in California this morning. The book, by the way, has been selected as a finalist for the National Book Award. The awards will be announced in mid-November. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Next is someone in Urbana. Line 1. Hello.
Hello. I think the re-examination of what has happened in Iraq is invaluable, and I praise you for doing that. However, there is one thing. I think we have to stop accepting Bush's statement that we were there to bring democracy to the Middle East. We have to look at the evidence. While Bush was saying this, he was building 4 major permanent military bases in Iraq and 10 lesser permanent bases. The neocon theoreticians were talking about the virtues of empire. Friedman, in particular, was praising the virtues of the second century Roman Empire. I think he didn't know very much about the second century Roman Empire, and it certainly was not a democracy. I think when Bush says a democracy, he means compliant puppet governments. And I think we simply have to accept that's what the aim was, not building democracy, and that was part of what led to the debacle.
Well, I don't see a huge contradiction in between the president's stated goal to democratize Iraq and the construction of permanent military bases in Iraq. I think that what the president and what members of his administration believed, and perhaps to a degree may still believe, although I think maybe they're beginning to sense reality a little bit more here, is that a new Iraqi government, what they hoped would be a secular, westward-leaning Iraqi government, would welcome the presence of American bases in many ways, like Germany's government and Japan's government and Korea's government have done. And so I think that they didn't see a contradiction there. Your caller is right to point out the contradiction between the stated goal of democratizing the Middle East and, for instance, continued support to Hosni Mubarak in Egypt or King Abdullah in Jordan or the Saudi royal family. It certainly raises questions about, all right, if you want to be out democratizing the Middle East, why are you continuing to support and cozy up to autocratic regimes? But I think that, People may call me a bit naive for this, but I believe that the administration in some ways is sincere when it says it really wanted to democratize Iraq. I think that was its goal. Now, we can all have a very healthy argument and discussion about whether that was, you know, A, realistic, and B, most importantly, as I write in the book, whether they actually went about this in the right way. I mean, I think that it was possible to create something of a more stable democracy in Iraq had the appropriate resources been brought to bear to help with reconstruction, to ensure adequate security, to have a plan for a quick political transition to an Iraqi-led interim government. I think that we could be in a very different situation today. So I don't accept that this was all that chaos was inevitable, as some argue today.
I want to thank again the caller for his comments. Invite other people who have questions. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. How was it that that Bremer was selected to be the head of the coalition authority?
It's a very good question, and there's no good clear answer. Certainly, the White House was looking for somebody charismatic and a sort of a take charge guy to replace General Jay Garner, who's the first American civilian administrator in Iraq. Bremer came to the White House's attention in a couple of different ways. He was good friends with Scooter Libby, Vice President Cheney's former chief of staff, and by all accounts, his name was sort of first proposed up by the Vice President's office, and then sort of seized upon by Defense Secretary Rumsfeld, who kind of officially sought to hire him and send him out to Baghdad. There was a thought among some that because Bremer was a former American ambassador, that he was recruited by the State Department. But Colin Powell was totally cut out of the loop on this and so many other issues. Powell really didn't know that Bremer was being hired until the day before Bremer was announced as the new envoy to Iraq.
It seems that here that the Coalition Provisional Authority suffered from some of the same structural problems as the war effort generally, at least in the sense that Paul Bremer worked for and answered to Don Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense. The CPA was under the Department of Defense. There was very little involvement from people in the Department of State. What few were there ended up really being marginalized.
That's very correct. And the Defense Department really didn't pay much attention to the Coalition Provisional Authority. Bremer had a very long leash. He managed to very smartly, for his purposes, convince Stephen Hadley, who was then Condi Rice's deputy at National Security Council, to exempt him from having to submit his executive orders through the interagency approval process. So Bremer was essentially a viceroy. He was doing what he wanted to do out there without a whole lot of consultation with Washington, without having to run a lot of stuff by Rumsfeld. In fact, the order to dissolve Iraq's army was never really officially vetted with Rumsfeld. Bremer left a copy of the order on Rumsfeld's desk with a note saying, "This is what I'm thinking of doing." But there wasn't really a robust discussion among senior administration officials about that very issue. And Bremer operated on his own so much that one of Rice's top deputies at the NSC took to checking the CPA's website on a daily basis to see what orders Bremer had issued, because it was faster than waiting to get them through official channels.
It's also what's sort of ironic, given the fact that the Coalition Provisional Authority was under the Department of Defense. It seems that the CPA staff and the military people who were there in Iraq, the soldiers, did not get on well. And in fact, part of the problem was, maybe the big problem was, is that the CPA staff didn't have a whole lot of respect for the soldiers.
Exactly right. I mean, the young neocons who showed up there viewed career military officers as old school thinkers. You know, these were people who believed in a big army, who didn't believe in nation building, who, you know, what were wanted to apply the lessons of the Balkans or, you know, to Iraq. And these young kids sort of treated people who've been in the military for 20 years who were majors and colonels like they're errand boys. They made them fetch documents and drive around. And it was really, really shocking to see that. And the military officers I found in Iraq were actually fairly well informed about what was happening on the ground. And oftentimes the soldiers were the ones who were out and about. They were driving through the cities. They were interacting with ordinary Iraqis. They were among the first to see the disastrous consequences of Bremer's de-Ba'athification order. They were far more pragmatic. They knew what it was sort of going to take to try to stabilize the country. They wanted to see small-scale reconstruction projects start quickly. But their views were very quickly and very often discounted by the civilians in the palace who had their own notions of what to do.
There are a number of things that have been cited now over and over again as major mistakes that Paul Bremer made. And you've mentioned a couple of them. One, the disbanding of the Iraqi army. The other, that he fired any Iraqi government employee who belonged to the Ba'ath Party, which would have been just about everybody. You had to belong to the party, and that meant that what he did was he got rid of people who actually had expertise in governing and running things. Exactly. So those are the two things, and I think that they're pointed to again and again. Was there something else that you would say, you know, that you would add to this list, maybe even move up a little bit higher in the list of those things that you think were really serious mistakes that the guy who was in charge there of the CPA made?
Of course, and a lot of the book details a lot of these other things because, you know, we all know about de-Ba'athification and dissolving the army. Well, there's a whole other world of mistakes, and one of them clearly is the hiring of people and the recruitment process. The other is Bremer's approach to the actual governance of Iraq. Instead of moving with alacrity to really give meaningful authority to the Iraqi people and to set up a Iraqi-led interim government that would have shown to the world and, more importantly, to the Iraqi people that the Iraqis were in charge of their destiny, he relegated the Iraqis to an advisory role with his governing council, and he retained the sole executive authority. And then, certainly in the world of economic development, this failure to actually mount an aggressive jobs program and instead, changing the tax code and doing things like that, squandering opportunities with rebuilding Iraq's healthcare system, its education system. And there was this sense that to fix Iraq, what you need to do is just write some new laws. You know, that's how we do it in America, because we have a bureaucracy that can implement laws. We have infrastructure. We have civil society. We have all the component parts that make democracy work. Well, that didn't exist in Iraq. And Bremer's people nevertheless figured, you know, you want to fix traffic congestion in Iraq, well, let's write a brand new traffic law. And they did. They've given Iraq a new traffic code modeled after the one in the state of Maryland. You know, we wrote a law that says that Iraqis must hold the steering wheel with both hands. Pedestrians walking on the road at dusk and at dark should wear light and reflective clothing. You shouldn't use your horn excessively. I mean, this was micromanagement of the worst sort. You know, didn't need to be wasting our time doing that. Didn't need to be wasting our time writing a brand new intellectual property law for the Iraqi people. The resources could have been far better spent, the human resources and the financial resources, in those early months. I mean, we did have a window of opportunity. I mean, sure, American forces weren't greeted with flowers and sweets like some had predicted, but the Iraqis were happy to be liberated. The Americans did have political capital in those early months, and instead of capitalizing upon it, we seemed to turn almost every opportunity we had into another chance for the Iraqi people to hate us.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Rajiv Chandrasekaran. He is assistant managing editor of The Washington Post, and from April 2003 to October 2004, he was the Post's bureau chief in Baghdad. He is the author of a new book about the American occupation of Iraq. It is titled Imperial Life in the Emerald City, Inside Iraq's Green Zone. It's out now. It's published by Knopf. He's in California this morning. He's been traveling around the country talking about the book. Questions are welcome. We do have a couple of people here who are ready to go. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Champaign County, line 1. Hello.
Hi. I heard you on another show where you said that the most of the 51 edicts, or 53, whatever they were, maybe I'm putting words in your mouth, but the general impact was that this is against the laws of occupation. This is against an international law. This is not only inefficient and stupid and one-dimensional, it's also not legal for an occupying army to reorder the economy in that fashion. We can only accept democracies that come out the way we want to, and we have evidence of two coups while the Iraq War was going on in our own backyard, Haiti and Venezuela, and more evidence coming out on that effect. I actually wanted to call and ask you about the other thing that I've heard other people say, that not hiring Iraqis, but hiring third party. The Chicago Tribune did some contemporaneous reporting on baiting and switching, and Nepalese workers who thought they were going to Amman, Jordan, to work in a hotel, and they end up in the green zone. And the fact that, you know, bringing these people in when the Iraqis were having 40% unemployment, I wanted you to see whether you have that in your book or whether you tried to file those kind of stories.
I certainly have that in my book. I mentioned it. I wrote about it while I was there, but it is something that you can even find in the first chapter of the book. Iraqis were excluded from a lot of jobs in the green zone, including, you know, working in the kitchen because they were petrified the Iraqis might poison them. But in many other functions there, they brought in a lot of third country nationals, Indians, Pakistanis, Nepalese, as you mentioned, Filipinos. And there were, you know, ample opportunities, I think, to give Iraqis jobs that instead went to people from other countries because it was just somehow easier or cheaper for Halliburton, which was the primary company hiring these people through subcontractors. It was, I think, easier and cheaper for them to do it that way. But, of course, as you correctly point out, over the long term, not in the best interests of Iraq, because you're not putting that money into the local economy. You're not helping unemployed local people. And also, it's not just in guarding and in cooking, but in the real business of reconstruction. You know, the U.S. government had pledged to employ 250,000 Iraqis with the reconstruction funds by the summer of 2004. And as I wrote about in the Post at the time, they were only employing about 15,000 people. It was just a shockingly small number of people employed. Getting to your first point or your first question, I think you have me half right there. What I was saying was that many of the economic policies that were promulgated by the CPA appeared to be, or at least the policies they tried to enact, appeared to be in violation of international laws and international treaties that specify what an occupying power can and can't do. And the best example here was the CPA's desire to privatize Iraqi-run companies. Let me make that more accurate. Government-run, state-owned enterprises in Iraq. Under Saddam's government, there were lots of government-owned factories, and the CPA wanted to sell these off. Well, there are treaties that say that an occupying power cannot sell off the property of an occupied nation. It's only up to the people of that country to do, or sovereign government. But there was a view inside the Green Zone that international law really didn't matter, that they had all the authority they needed from the UN Security Council resolution that essentially endorsed the occupation, and they should push right ahead. In the end, the privatization never happened because they just didn't have the resources to do it, and it wasn't practical to do it, but not because of any lack of will to do it.
Well, there were other things, too, and one of the few things that was left on the books by Bremer was some Saddam-era anti-union thing. I would ask you, while you're on your book tour, to get back with your colleagues and make sure somebody else is covering that beat, because what I've heard is that Triple Canopy has, or one of the military contracting sorts, have imported 700 Peruvians to guard the Green Zone. And I just haven't seen that anywhere else but Alternet and things like that. And it's astonishing how much this looks like an empire using the troops from another country. The correct term from the Roman era escapes me at this point, but You have imperial in your title too, so I think we're all conflicted about this. We don't want to live in an empire, but it sure is acting like one. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Phil, thanks for your call. And, you know, penetrating these security companies is very, very difficult. Unlike the military, they don't have press officers. They don't have any obligation to talk publicly. There are a lot of smart reporters who've been out trying to chip away at the story, and one of my colleagues from the Post is working on a series of stories on this very issue. So stay tuned to the Post, and hopefully in the next few months there will be a series of very revelatory stories about the very shadowy, murky world of private security firms operating in Iraq.
Well, to what extent were decisions made by the Coalition Provisional Authority influenced by people who were in the position to make money?
Well, you know, I can't demonstrate, at least not in my reporting, direct connections. But, you know, there was a case, for instance, where a large contract to rebuild Iraq's indigenous media network, the state-run TV station and a newspaper, was given to a company called SAIC, Science Applications International Corporation, a large defense contractor, which incidentally had no prior experience doing the sort of thing. And as I detail in my book, it turned into something of a catastrophe, and they lost their contract at the end of 2003. But it's interesting to note that that contract was issued by Doug Feith's office in the Pentagon. Doug Feith's deputy was a former senior executive at this very firm before he joined the Pentagon.
You talked earlier in response to the very first caller about the fact that when you were there, that it was very difficult to get access to CPA staff people because the Coalition Provisional Authority was very careful to try to control your reporters of access to CPA people and essentially overall to control the kind of information that was coming out about the occupation. And that, in fact, a lot of the interviews that you did for the book were after the CPA was shut down. You talked to people after they had already come back to the United States, some of them people who are still working in government and would only talk to you not for attribution because they were afraid if their names were attached to their comments, they would lose their jobs. When you talk to those people now, what sort of sense do you get about their thought about the future? And is there any sort of shred of optimism about things turning around, or how long it would take to do the kind of rebuilding that this administration has talked about wanting to do?
That's a good question, David. You know, many of those people have become really disillusioned. I'm quite frankly surprised at the degree to which they have, in some cases, you know, either lost hope or have come back feeling very burned. You know, they went out there as true believers, thinking that they were going to participate in this grand effort to remake a country, bring democracy, bring stability. And it wasn't until many of them returned home that they began to really realize the failings of the policy. And, you know, very many of them from afar now look at it and are really demoralized. As I write in my prologue, and this was an individual who was actually saying this at the time, right before he left in the summer of 2004, talking to a man who is a lifelong Republican, friends with Rumsfeld and his wife and with the vice president's wife, and he went out there to rebuild the higher education system, and he quickly learned that there wasn't a whole lot of money set aside to help rebuild Iraq's looted universities. His ability to travel to universities was increasingly circumscribed. And before he left, he told me in the palace that he felt like a neoconservative who's been mugged by reality. And there have been a number of others, I think, who would sort of feel the same way. And also, to be sure here, there are plenty of people who were there who are still back in the country now who still think things will be fine one day, that, you know, just give it another few months, another year or two, and Iraq will be back on its feet, that the CPA has set the conditions for success there. But I dare say now that's a minority view.
I think that certainly the president and other people speaking for the administration have been frequently critical of the media coverage, saying, oh, you guys, you reporters, you're always reporting the bad stuff. You never report any of the good stuff. You never say anything positive. Can you point to your experiences covering the CPA and actually find something that you can point to rather than all of these things we've been talking about that they did wrong or they did poorly, are there things that you can actually point to and say, well, now here actually was a case where they did something right?
Yes, and I detail some of them in my book to give it some balance here. And, you know, one good case was how we tried to reach out to Iraqi weapons scientists. And it was a case of a young man from the State Department who went out to Baghdad and had to break a lot of rules to do this because there were people in the Defense Department who really had a very punitive view toward Iraqi scientists. But this young man felt that it was important to show the Iraqi scientists that they would be respected, that they would have a future in the country, so they wouldn't go off to Iran or North Korea or Syria and sell their talents in making weapons of mass destruction. You know, we all know that there were no WMDs in Iraq from before the war, but there certainly were people who had skills to do bad things. And he set up a science center as a way to help train and bring these scientists back into the fold, make them feel respected, give them a chance to interact with each other. And I think that was one of the great successes of the occupation. But he did so largely because of his own creativity, his drive to do it, and not because he was getting a lot of help from the bureaucracy.
All right. Well, we're going to have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. If you want to read the book, it is out now, Imperial Life in the Emerald City, Inside Iraq's Green Zone, published by Knopf, by our guest, Rajiv Chandrasekharan. He is assistant managing editor of the Washington Post and a former bureau chief in Baghdad for the Post. The book's been named as finalist for the National Book Award. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
It was a pleasure to talk to you, David.